on for petitions relating to recusal and for anyone who wishes to appear, please give your name to the marshal. The first one on my list is Adam Skaggs of the Brennan Center. Mr. Skaggs. Welcome to Wisconsin.
Thank you very much. Thank you, Chief Justice. My name is Adam Skaggs, and I am counsel with the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University School of Law. The Brennan Center is a nonpartisan public policy and law institute that focuses on fundamental issues of democracy and justice. Through our Fair Courts program, we work to preserve fair and impartial courts and their role as the ultimate guarantor of equal justice in our constitutional democracy. On behalf of the Brennan Center, I thank your honors for your leadership in examining when financing and conduct of judicial campaigns may warrant recusal. Already today, we've heard from a range of speakers. We've heard a number of different perspectives. And while there has, I think, certainly not been agreement on every issue, I think what does unite all the speakers is the agreement that developing effective judicial disqualification standards is crucial to ensure continued public confidence in the judiciary's independence and impartiality. The Brennan Center has previously filed rather extensive comments on the first two petitions filed in this proceeding, and we've also addressed some additional issues that we think are ripe for your consideration beyond those specifically introduced by the petitions. In the interest of time, I do not plan to go over all the subjects that we covered, but would simply refer to you to those written comments.
They're dated October 9, 2009.
I believe that is correct, okay. Your Honor. Our written comments include several proposals that aim at recusal procedures and also proposals aimed at ensuring greater transparency in the recusal process. But we've come here today because of several petitions that specifically deal with substantive proposals that implicate campaign fundraising and campaign spending, both by candidates themselves as well as by independent third-party groups. And as the Supreme Court's Caperton decision makes abundantly clear, this is a hugely important subject. So again, I thank your honors. This hearing could not have come at a more important time. Two trends relating to the funding of judicial elections warrant at least a very quick comment. First, as we've already heard a bit this morning, the amount of money in judicial races has dramatically increased. The past 10 years have seen a doubling of the amount of money, more than a doubling of the amount of money in judicial races across the country from the 10 years prior to that. And simultaneously to that development, individual races have become much more expensive. At the same time, there's also been a huge upsurge in the involvement of third-party groups. Their spending has often dwarfed the spending of the candidates themselves. The most recent Supreme Court contest here in Wisconsin is illustrative of that trend. Third-party groups bought more than $3 million worth of television advertisements, which was approximately 90% of all the television ads that aired in that contest.
I think you must mean not the most recent one. That's when the Chief Justice ran. That was last year. Is that really what you're talking
about? You're right. I'm sorry. It was the previous cycle. Thank you for that. Given the runaway spending in judicial elections and the fact that the First Amendment does make it difficult or impossible to restrict that spending on the front end, there is an increasing consensus that back-end solutions that involve judicial recusal disqualification practices may be the most effective and a necessary attempt to address the growing perception among the public that justice is for sale. Let me share a couple of figures that I think support that contention. The public is concerned of the influence of campaign contributions and spending on the bench. A February 2009 national poll conducted by Harris Interactive revealed that more than 80% of respondents believe judges should avoid cases that involve major campaign contributors. 81% believe a disinterested judge should have the final word on recusal or disqualification motions. A USA Today Gallup poll also conducted in February reached very similar conclusions. It found that 89% of those surveyed believed the influence of campaign contributors on judicial decision-making can be a problem.
What was the dollar amount on the Gallup poll? What was the dollar amount that was proposed?
I don't recall the specific amounts that were in that survey.
The Justice at Stake poll had $50,000 is the amount. Is that right?
I believe that's correct, but I can't say for sure. Mm-hmm. Judge Crabb, sitting in the federal court in the Western District of Wisconsin, issued an opinion earlier this year in which similar data was cited, dealing specifically with Wisconsin respondents. 600 respondents in that survey reported believing 78% of those respondents believed that campaign contributions have either, quote, a great deal or, quote, some influence on Wisconsin judges' decisions. And notably, 65% of the respondents in that survey supported public financing. We believe that substantive and procedural reforms of the recusal process will go a long way to responding to the public's fear that justice can go to the highest bidders. And like all of the petitioners here today, we believe that the court should adopt a substantive rule or rules dealing with contributions and independent expenditures.
What's the dollar amount that you think we ought to impose as the threshold amount?
Well, I don't want to offer a specific dollar figure. In our written comments that we offered, we suggested a sort of holistic rule, maybe the most appropriate rule, in which the court may suggest that looking at the totality of circumstances is the most effective way to assess whether a judge's impartiality may be questioned.
Sorry, continue.
That's quite all right. I think that what...
I'm going to move off that point. Then what's your position on the, we have four proposals, two of a dollar amount, two do not. What's your
Well, that's right.
That?
I think certainly if the court were to examine these issues, it could set a dollar amount. I think it may be problematic to set a single dollar amount for some of the reasons that some of the justices brought up this morning. Circuit court races may have a very different characteristics in the amount of money that's involved in those. It may be appropriate to set one figure for those sorts of races and one figure for races for the Supreme Court, for example. Again, though, I believe that some of the other factors, Chief Judge Abramson, that you mentioned earlier today, the timing of contributions, the percentage of contributions that Justice Ziegler was talking about earlier, are important factors to consider when assessing whether disqualification is appropriate. And for those reasons, I think the petitions of the manufacturers and the Realtors Association may be somewhat problematic. We heard counsel for the manufacturers say, I think rightly, that the totality of circumstances should be considered. I would agree with that. My concern is that by adopting a rule along the lines of what the Realtors and the manufacturers have proposed, that totality analysis could be swallowed by the specific mention of one particular factor in isolation, whether it be the contributions or whether it be the independent expenditures.
But, counsel, by the converse, the totality of the circumstances would be swallowed by an absolute limit that required absolute recusal.
Well, I think that's right. I mean, obviously, an absolute single-dollar threshold mm-hmm. has the advantage of easy application. It's
well, if that's your goal, if your goal is easy application, that's pretty cool.
I think more important than, and as we heard this morning, it may not always be so easy even to apply, even if the numbers are fixed. But I think more important than that even is something that looks at all the different factors, and that's why I would urge the court to consider committing these issues, all of these issues raised by the petitions, to a committee or a commission to study these issues in more depth before.
Okay, so you're in favor of our referring them rather than deciding on any of them today?
I think that that would make sense. Just to finish the thought, why I find that the manufacturers and the realtors' proposals somewhat problematic. By issuing a rule that deals only with one of the many factors that are implicated in these circumstances, I think it could give the impression that that, in fact, is the only issue that needs to be considered.
I think the petitions say solely on the basis. So I think it's pretty clear that what they're saying is they don't want a judge to have to recuse based only on the dollar amount of a contribution or some type of independent expenditure. But I think they both agreed, or at least I thought, that that was a factor that could be considered in the totality of circumstances.
I think that's right. I would not disagree. I think, however, by elevating that one factor in the text of a rule, it could, in effect, overshadow later part of the rule it said, but of course you can think of other things. And I'm reminded of that canon of statutory construction that I will not attempt to pronounce, that we learned in our first year of law school, that by explicitly listing certain factors...
Exclusio omnes exclusio.
Well, your Latin is far, far better than mine, so
only
thank
because you don't understand it.
My point is simply that by elevating those factors to explicit mention in a rule, it could have the unfortunate and unintended, I would submit, consequence of suggesting that other factors were not as important in the totality analysis.
I talk about other factors. I mean, when you talk about contributions, it's easy to talk about timing, percent. What about other factors like... personal friendship, previously a member of the firm, campaign speech, I mean the whole free speech, whole multitude of factors. Would you put those in?
Well, I think some of those factors already are addressed in existing code. Involvement of a family member, for example,
right.
in the case. So I'm not sure that those factors need to be readdressed.
Factors
by
are
the court.
Sticking towards the particular case involved and money.
Right, exactly. And I think simply looking at a rule that just deals with the financing of campaigns, it's an important area. It's as some of the figures I shared suggest it's an increasingly important area, and I think that a rule specifically dealing with funding candidates and the spending of candidates and independent groups is an area that the court would be well advised to issue a rule.
Something that occurred to me during my non-lunch hour was suppose you had expenditures within the legal limits, which, as you know, range in Wisconsin, and they came not from any particular organization, but all of this money, or a large percent of the money, came from people heavily identified as big contributors to a particular political party. So the campaign collects $300,000, and $250,000 are from well-known national, you know, money people. I'm sorry, I don't know the lingo well enough, but you probably do. The heavy hitters.
Sure.
So you got 90% coming from people identified with a particular party, and we get cases and maybe they'll come up on redistricting, reapportionment, which are political things. Do any of the proposals before us cover that?
Well, I'm not sure that they do, and there may be good reason for that. I think as the source of the money becomes more distant
attenuated.
And more indirect and attenuated, thank you, it becomes more and more difficult to craft a rule. I mean, there may be situations where it is impossible to capture every possible scenario that could be perceived. Mm-hmm. In contrast, though, to that hypothetical, I would refer back to a hypothetical that you suggested earlier, where 20 members of a single company
right.
gave legal contributions $10,000, and that was 80% or 75 or 90% of the entire campaign war chest that was collected in that race. I would think that while each and every one of those individual contributions was certainly legal and would perhaps alone not give rise to the same inference that there was a question of a reasonable observer, I think that under those circumstances, recusal would be appropriate. I think that when a single company with a case before the court is responsible, its employees or its officers, directors are responsible for such a vast percentage of that candidate's fundraising, it would give rise to a situation not unlike Caperton.
Yeah, Caperton was pending. You know, if you go to the Grisham book on the appeal, you know it's coming. It may not be there yet, but it's a coming. And cases are known to be a coming because they're sitting in the circuit court. But suppose you've got the sense that it's going to come, but you don't know which case, when, and it may be 5 years hence. What's your duration on this? One of the states I looked at, the duration was the entire time period of the judge. For here, it would be 10 years. For the other judges, 6 years, so that you accumulated all the funds over the six-year period.
Well, I think here, again, it's a difficult area to draw lines. I would certainly suggest that the longer the time period, the more problematic a rule calling for recusal would be. I think, again, to point back to Caperton, one of the key factors that Justice Kennedy pointed out was the fact that the pendency of the case, the specific case, while the campaign was going on and while the spending was going on. And I think, again, under a sort of totality of circumstances test, which also had as one of the factors whether or not the litigation in question was pending at the time the spending occurred, it would give the court an opportunity to respond to that situation in a much more appropriate way than I would suggest looking at a 10-year-old contribution for a case that had not yet been filed. I don't think that situation would give rise to the same concerns.
The issue of waiver came up this morning, and your materials talk about waiver, that is, somebody can give $10,000 to a judge and try and get them off the case.
Mm-hmm.
And so that's why you suggest a waiver provision.
Well, I think were the court going to adopt a per se disqualification rule that was triggered by spending at a certain threshold, a waiver provision would be necessary to craft.
Not if it's a general, more general.
I don't think under a more general totality of circumstances test, a waiver provision would be as important.
What about the requirement of disclosure statement by parties that when they submit their briefs, they make disclosure of what they know? Because one of the problems is if there's a campaign and it has 5 to 6 or more thousand contributors, unless you search every time there's a case and can broaden a search beyond the named parties or the named lawyers, you've got a slight problem for the judge.
Well, certainly, and administrating such a rule under those circumstances could be difficult. I do think it would be appropriate for the court to consider a rule under which litigants in a case would file a disclosure similar to a Rule 26-1 disclosure that's filed in federal litigation that detailed what the contributions and expenditures in a particular election were when that judge was presiding over the proceeding. Obviously, this would be much more narrowly tailored than something requiring all individuals to disclose all of their independent expenditures, and I would not suggest such a rule as sweeping as that. But I would suggest that in order to protect the due process rights of litigants on both sides of a particular dispute, it would be helpful for parties to file such an affidavit. You know, one of the things that was discussed this morning is the fact that often the source of money is not clear. And while I certainly agree that that is an issue, and that's why this disclosure proposal, we have submitted this proposal, I think that in many cases there is broad public understanding of where money comes from, even if it's not clear exactly what conduits it went through. So I think often the public has a sense of where funds are coming from that are running certain ads and that sort of thing. And so I think adding transparency to the process would be a huge step forward to increasing public confidence that the system was operating fairly. Already judges are required to provide information in their possession about issues that might pertain to recusal questions, and I think having the litigants do so would increase transparency and would be effective.
I have another question, and that is in these materials, there's a conversation about having the judge give an explanation of why he/she recuses and why he/she doesn't recuse. What do you think of that?
Well, again, I think a requirement such as that required an explanation whether recusal was occurred or did not occur would, again, be very helpful at increasing transparency in the system and therefore increasing public confidence that the system is operating fairly and the way it's intended to. I think that to the extent individual litigants will be better served by having those reasons laid out in the record or laid out in court, it will definitely be a plus. I also think it will help to develop a body of precedent so that judges can see what other judges did under the same circumstances, and I think that will also make the system function more effectively.
We don't have in our statutory, and in Wisconsin is a peculiar provision that both the legislative and judicial branches can adopt pleading practice and procedure rules. We don't have an equivalent to Section 455A. Any justice judge shall disqualify himself or herself in any proceeding in which his or her impartiality might reasonably be questioned. What do you think of that?
Well, I think that's an excellent rule. I think Section 455 is a useful standard in its most general terms. I would suggest that it might be more effective and more practical if there were some factors that were laid out underneath that general standard.
And this one could be one.
Exactly. And already we have situations dealing with family members or former representation of a party. But I think that laying out similar factors that would guide a judge's decision-making, such as the amount of contributions, its proportion in relation to the entire amount that was raised in that race, the timing and whether or not the litigation was pending, and those sorts of factors, I think laying those out beneath such a general reasonableness standard would be particularly helpful, both for the public to understand what was at issue in any particular motion for recusal, and also for helping judges faced with such a motion to apply the relevant factors.
The court has your document, and sorry I've taken so long and asked some questions, but I don't get that opportunity often.
It's a pleasure.
And so if you have a final concluding statement that's short, that'll be fine.
The last thought that I would leave the court with is that we heard this morning, and I was somewhat surprised, that the only issue that has brought us here today is the First Amendment. And I agree entirely that the First Amendment is an extraordinarily important issue, and it is obviously one that is clearly implicated by the discussion we're having today. But I would suggest there are other factors, other rights at issue as well. The due process rights of litigants, the rights of the public to a judiciary that is perceived and actually carries out impartial justice. And so I would urge the court to consider those comments and those holdings of cases like White and Caperton, as well as the opinion issued in Siegelman by Judge Crabb earlier this year in the Western District of Wisconsin, that suggests the First Amendment is clearly important. The First Amendment clearly protects certain campaign expression, certain rights of association around campaigns, but that does not override the rights of litigants when they enter the courtroom and that judicial candidate has become a judge and presides over that litigation. So I would urge the court to revisit those important cases and to consider that recusal may be the most effective way of responding to the need to ensure clearly fair and impartial tribunals. At the same time, the court recognizes that campaigns will involve expression, association, and other important First Amendment protected rights.
So to summarize, you let them spend the money, let the candidates talk, but then you get it at recusal.
Let's have as freewheeling and wide-ranging debate as we need in our judicial elections so that the public can make well-informed decisions about who will sit on the bench. But when that First Amendment conduct raises legitimate questions in the eyes of litigants and, as importantly, in the public as a whole about whether or not these judges are beholden to those interests that supported them in the campaigns, let's address that through recusal.
Any other questions? Justice Prosser.
Could you tell us a little bit more about the Brennan Center? It's a public policy group?
It's a nonprofit organization that does public policy advocacy. We also do public interest litigation at times when that's a means of advancing the issues that we believe are important.
An advocacy group?
In part, yes.
Has the Brennan Center taken a position on the desirability of appointment of judges or justices versus the election of justices?
The Brennan Center has. The Brennan Center's position is that either in an elective system or in an appointed system, it is possible for fair and impartial justice to be achieved. The Brennan Center does not favor appointment over elections. It doesn't favor elections over appointment. The Brennan Center believes that both sorts of systems can be improved through a variety of mechanisms, recusal being one of those. But certainly we have not ever taken, and I think would never take, the position that judicial elections should be, that we should get judicial elections entirely. We defended very recently the North Carolina public financing system because of our belief that that enabled the judicial elections in North Carolina to function more smoothly than they had previously. A few years prior to that, we initiated litigation in New York State, which we eventually took all the way to the Supreme Court, in which we sought to have the courts impose an election system that would actually be responsive to the public and actually give voters a real voice in the system, because under New York's current system, the voters are really effectively excluded from choosing who the candidates are that run for judicial office. So we have, in fact, litigated to try and deliver elections to the people, in this case of New York State, that would enable the people to have a voice in the elective process and not let those decisions be controlled by party bosses effectively in backroom, smoke-filled rooms.
So if I were to suggest that Brennan Center prefers appointment and then perhaps some sort of retention election, would you say I'm wrong?
I would say that the Brennan Center certainly has supported states that have chosen to adopt that sort of system, the Missouri plan, if you want to use the shorthand to refer to that. And we certainly have spoken out for the right of states if they choose, if they find that that is the most effective system for selecting their judges. We believe states have the right to do that. We would be concerned to ensure that such a system functioned as effectively as possible to keep partisan or special interest influence out of that process. But I would suggest we would have the same approach to elective systems.
Would it be fair to say that former Justice Sandra Day O'Connor favors the appointment of justices and judges?
Well, obviously, I cannot speak for former Justice O'Connor. To my understanding, I think that would be fair.
Okay. Would it be fair to say that your position is different from her position?
I would say that we have not reached the same position. We have not decided we need to choose one or the other. She has decided that she will favor one system over the other. We have decided not to take a position along those lines, but instead to work within either sort of a system to try and improve that system.
Now, are you affiliated with Justice at Stake?
We are a partner in the Justice at Stake campaign.
What does that mean?
Well, Justice at Stake, and there's a representative of that group here who can speak more effectively than I can about that organization, but my understanding is that Justice at Stake serves as sort of an umbrella organization. I believe there are more than 50 other organizations that are, I believe they are referred to as member organizations of the Justice at Stake campaign. And the Brennan Center is one of those organizations. I hope that's helpful in responding to your question.
I think you indicated that there is a good deal of public concern about the money that's going into judicial campaigns. How would you explain that phenomenon?
The phenomenon being the public concern or the money going into elections?
Well, maybe both. There's two-part question.
Well, I'm sure there are many reasons for both phenomenon. From one explanation for the amount of money that is flowing into campaigns is reflected by a comment from an AFL-CIO official who said we learned long, and I believe that was in Ohio, who said we learned long ago that it was a lot easier to get a majority out of a 7-member body than it would be out of a 200-member body. I'm paraphrasing the quote, but the suggestion is that interest groups have determined that they may be able to advance their agendas through having an influence on the judges that compose the membership of the bench, rather than trying to elect the vastly larger number of legislators that it would take to achieve a majority within a legislative body. So I think groups probably on both sides of the ideological spectrum have sought to increase their influence in judicial elections with the hope of electing judges that are more sympathetic or perhaps more responsive to their agenda. The public perception that this is a problem, that the money creates issues that are worthy of dealing with, I think could be explained perhaps just by the amount of money that has been spent in these races, perhaps in part by the tone that television advertising has increasingly taken on. We've seen, as the amount of money that has flowed into judicial elections, we've seen the tenor, the character of those elections shift a bit, I would represent. We have seen once sort of sleepy, quiet, low-key affairs become increasingly, begin increasingly to resemble races for any other executive or legislative office. And by that I mean we've seen an increase in negative ads, we've seen an increase in the sharpness of the tone in television advertising and judicial elections. And so I think perhaps what is happening is the public is perceiving that these races are becoming nastier, they're becoming louder and more expensive, and that is raising questions in the public's mind about whether these judges are unfortunately being forced to in effect, stand in the shoes of the other politicians we see in the other branches of government.
Would it be fair to say Brennan Center itself has often said, this is a problem, this is a problem, this is a problem, and that you've gotten a pretty good hearing on that?
Well, we have certainly documented the increasing amounts of money that are spent in elections. We, I think it's fair to say, have suggested that the increasing amounts of money has been problematic. And I suppose we have gotten some attention for those statements and the reports that we put out on those issues.
Any other questions or comments? Well, you had a long 10 minutes.
I certainly appreciate your allowing me to speak, and I again thank you all for your attention to this important issue and for giving us the opportunity to share our comments with you today. Thank you.
Thank you, counsel. Mr. Robinson, justice at stake.
Thank you, Your Honor. I apologize, I have a cold, and so if I sound funny, I feel like I sound funny.
Do we have to do a swab to see if you have flu?
I do not. Thank you. Your Honors, my name is John Robinson. I'm from Justice at Stake. I'm the state director. We are a nonpartisan campaign working to keep our courts fair and impartial. We are part of a national coalition of concerned civic and legal leaders promoting substantive and procedural reforms, seeking in particular to reduce situations where judicial campaign conduct, campaign cash, or special interest pressure could cast the impartiality of judges into doubt. We have more than 50 partner organizations, including the Brennan Center, from across America and across the political spectrum, and our board consists of judges, academics, business, and political leaders, Democrats and Republicans. Justice State receives its funding from a number of foundations, including OSI, which Justice Gableman brought up earlier, but we also receive funding from a number of other foundations, including the Joyce Foundation, which covers the majority of our work in the Midwest and Wisconsin. The Joyce Foundation's mission is to reduce poverty and violence in the region, to ensure residents good schools, decent jobs, strong democracy, and a diverse, thriving culture. Among the recipients of Joyce grants are the Cato Institute as well. Justice Stake has been active in urging states to adopt recusal reforms in the aftermath of the U.S. Supreme Court case, Caperton v. Massey, in which our organization filed an amicus brief. As the court observed, the requirements of constitutional due process set only the outer boundaries of judicial disqualifications, and many states have gone further and implemented judicial reforms to eliminate even the impartiality. We have urged states to adopt recusal standards that will reassure citizens that their courts will be fair and impartial, and in fact and in appearance. I'm not here today to focus on the details. The recusal reform petition submitted by the Lee Women Voters of Wisconsin, Wisconsin Realtors, or the Wisconsin Manufacturing and Commerce. Rather, here to applaud the court for being proactive in addressing this issue and to urge your honors to take affirmative steps to strengthen the judicial code in regards to recusal rules. Strong recusal rules protect the courts and public trust by removing even the appearance that justice might be for sale. As the Conference of Chief Justices noted in its Caperton amicus, as judicial election campaigns become costlier and more politicized, public confidence in the fairness and integrity of the nation's elected judges may be imperiled.
Counselor, you know, one thing that kind of comes to mind, and I'm not quite sure how to balance this. I understand the argument that if you give X amount of dollars, that's too much and there's a nexus, and so the justice should have to step off. But, you know, nobody gets elected in Wisconsin or anywhere else for $10,000. So if we pick Justice Babich's number for $10,000, and so we have that justice have to get off a case that involves an issue of statewide concern, which is the only kind of issue we take,
right,
then what about all the other people that gave $5, $10, $15, went out and voted for that justice because they think that justice is scholarly, will study the law, and come to a fair conclusion? They've been disenfranchised.
Right, and I agree with Justice Gableman's point earlier, which is that people do contribute because they think that those are the sorts of justices that will provide justice. So,
but my focus is a little bit different than that. It's you're trying to position the contribution of one person to have an effect on one justice. And I understand that argument, and I understand the concerns. But what bothers me, and what no one seems to be talking about, either you or other folks, is that there are thousands and thousands of other people in Wisconsin who will vote to elect a justice who may have given $5, $10, or nothing. And they want that justice to sit on the cases that are of statewide concern. We're just kind of leaving them out of our equation, aren't
right.
we?
And including the people that just volunteer and don't actually contribute any money.
That's what I mean.
They've yes.
contributed nothing. Don't even volunteer. Just go to the polls and vote for the person you think is best.
As far as a per se disqualification rule, we've heard of a $1,000 figure, a $10,000 figure. I believe the justices in Nevada are considering a $50,000 number.
It doesn't matter what number you pick.
Right.
It doesn't really matter.
Right. I agree with your point. I think it's.
I don't know how we take them into the equation. Do you have any suggestion about all those folks that either gave nothing or $5 or $10?
What I guess I would say that the point would be to avoid the appearance of impartiality, and that's to the public that one person or one group of people don't have a larger voice.
Yeah, I understand your argument, and I'm not trying to say it's not important. I think it's very important. But what nobody has talked about is all those other folks that voted for the justice that maybe gave the justice zero or gave the justice $5.
Right.
Have a right to have their vote honored.
Right, and that groundswell of democracy is what our country is founded on. I agree with you. And it just in terms of a per se disqualification rule, I guess it would be sort of seen as a de minimis. There would be a de minimis effect of influence, individual influence by those contributors. And it was only those larger contributions.
Well, it's not influence that I'm concerned about. What I'm concerned about is someone getting out to vote. We have a hard enough time getting folks out to vote for judicial elections. I think with the Chief Justice election, there were 18% that voted.
And I think our democracy is built. I mean, nobody here could run without contributions in general. So we don't want to discourage people from participating in democracy on any level. I agree.
But if we adopt any kind of a per se rule, we will be disenfranchising all those folks that gave nothing or $5. Anybody who voted, right, that didn't fit in that category that we're knocking out. So we're letting one person, one contributor, just say we pick $50,000. We do Justice Babich's thing, but we pick $50,000. And someone decides, oh, you know, this is the justice that I think is the most terrific. I'm going to run an independent ad myself. I'm going to pay $50,000. I'll go register at the board over there at GAB and tell them what I'm going to do. Then under that rule, that justice would have to get off of any case that person is on. Well, that's fine if you just look at it with blinders on. But that case has got to have an issue of statewide concern, or we would never grant the petition for review. So then you got all these other people that voted for that justice because, A, they think the justice is smart. B, they think the justice works hard. C, they're not persuaded that any kind of a limit on what is spent or not spent is a concern to them. They vote for the person they think is best. So it seems to me we've left all those folks kind of out of our equation. And I'm frankly not sure how you put them in it.
Well, no, I agree with you that there is it's tough to balance those interests of the appearance of impropriety against the, I guess, you know, whether or not there's an actual appearance of bias, whether there's just an appearance. So it's an imperfect situation, and that's a tough balancing test. And I appreciate you guys to having this hearing to talk about it. And I think I speak on behalf of Justice Stick when I say that I think we would be in favor of pushing for a task force or a commission to study this further, because I think there is, it's complicated, and I think there's no easy answers.
Oh, and I appreciate your coming, too. The more I think about this, though, it doesn't get simpler.
No.
It gets more complicated.
You know, Mr. Robinson, part of what Justice Rogan just said made me think of this in a little different terms. Having sat as a trial court judge, you have people right before you, and if there's an issue, you try to address it, and you can do a waiver, or you can just do the best you can to process the cases and give a fair shake. But at this level, it's a little different in that our decisions affect people all around the state. They aren't limited to the people who are before us. So part of the rub is if you're requiring justices to get off a case, it's really not fair for all those other people either, is it? It's one thing at the trial court level, because you put another judge in there, someone decides their case, it's another day, it's not that big of a deal. At the Supreme Court level, though, all those other people are not receiving what they deserve under the Constitution, and that is for us to decide the issue of statewide significance.
Right.
How do you reconcile that? That's a rub.
I agree. It's a difficult balance to know when you're protecting the appearance of the impartiality of the court versus the folks that have gone out and worked, volunteered, contributed, spoken to their friends about it, spoken in church at lunch hours about it.
I don't even mean that. I mean, you know, the case we decide, it doesn't just affect
right.
the state and Mr. Smith. It affects all the other potential people like Mr. Smith who might be in that circumstance, or how law enforcement deal with an issue, or how, you know, parties deal in contractual issues, or how real estate issues are resolved, or landlord-tenant cases, or juvenile cases, or family cases. I mean, they're of statewide significance, or else we won't be hearing them. But it's almost like the presumption is made that we're not deciding the issue of statewide significance. We're deciding the issue for one party or another, and that's it. We wouldn't be taking the case if that were the case. That's a trial-level concern, not a Supreme Court-level concern.
No, I agree with you. I agree with you that that each case is of statewide importance, and I would say that the power of the court and its authority comes from its respect from the people, and balancing those interests against the interests of maintaining an appearance statewide that the court has an appearance and it actually is impartial and has the appearance of impartiality is a hard balance. I agree.
Let me just ask you this one follow-up. If we had public financing, which I assume you're a proponent of, yes?
Yes.
Then would we have to recuse ourselves on every matter of legislative concern or executive concern? Because essentially they hold the purse strings for our elections.
I hope not.
Just asking. It creates more questions to me. I think this is really fascinating.
I understand. And going to your earlier question about merit selection, we are partners with the Brennan Center, and we're agnostic as to reform. We advocate reforms on many levels, and we are not proponents of merit in the sense of at the exclusion of others. We try to reform all aspects. There are of issues with merit selection and retention elections and issues with elections. We work to reform all the issues that crop up like this.
Counsel, the questions just asked remind me of question number 6 posed by Chief Justice Roberts in the Caperton case. And he, in that question, asks, does the analysis change depending on whether the judge whose qualification is sought, whose disqualification is sought, sits on a trial court, appeals court, or state Supreme Court? What's your answer to that question?
Well, I think one of the petitioners earlier was talking about waivers and whether or not a waiver was appropriate on an appellate level or on a district court level. So I think the analysis is different. I think on a district, hearing a case on first impression, I think taking a waiver is different than doing it on an appellate level. So, yeah, I think there is a different level of analysis.
Well, okay, so your answer is yes.
Yes.
So tell me why. There is a different level of analysis. Why and in what way does the analysis alter?
Because when you're hearing the, going back to the waiver issue, if you're hearing the case for the first time and you're ruling on issues of fact, I think setting the record there, if there's an appearance of bias, I think that's something where a waiver might be appropriate, whereas opposed to on an appellate level where the facts are already set, I think then the issue of waiver is critical.
So the money, the question of money, which is one of the questions we're dealing with here today, obviously, the campaign contributions, either individual or from special interests, that the equation in terms of how, on the issue of disqualification or recusal, fluctuates.
I think it does fluctuate, I think, because in Wisconsin there are different contributions level for different...
Other than that, other than the actual difference in levels.
Does
the due process question change given the level of the court? Does the First Amendment right change given the level of the court? Does the right of citizens to have a fair and impartial tribunal change given the level of the court?
No, I don't think so.
You know, in Caperton, though, a fundamental difference, and this, I think it deserves some emphasis, is that much like a trial court, where another trial court judge can step in and take a judge's spot and decide the case, and you get the benefit of a full trial and a judge, in Wisconsin, at this level, someone else doesn't step in and take our spot. But in Caperton, with that judge, that could have happened.
And
that is, I mean, there would have been a full court to hear that under their rules as they existed. Here, the rest of the citizens of the state are potentially deprived of a full court.
And disenfranchised from their vote, yeah.
It's different.
Yeah.
How does that differ if I look at 757.19? For instance, C, 2C. When a judge previously acted as counsel to any party in the same action or proceeding, or let me pick an easier one, perhaps E, when a judge of an appellate court previously handled the action or proceeding while judge of an inferior court. Let's say I was a circuit court judge in Marin County, in Marathon County, and years ago, and I sat on a case, and now, 8 years later, I'm on the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and the way that it's developed, and of course cases change in the appellate structure at the time, there's a real neat issue of constitutional dimension, Fourth Amendment, that I really didn't even address as a circuit court judge, wasn't even before me. Should I get off that case?
So this isn't a question of contributions or expenditures.
No, it's 757.19 is a policy determination of what rises to the level of when a judge should disqualify himself or herself from a proceeding. Now, if I get off that case, if I have to get off that case, never dealt with that issue, all those people, all those hundreds of thousands of people who voted for me, or didn't, don't get me on this case.
So should
we not have any 757.19?
I think, again, going back to the fact that the court's reputation is its strongest asset in the state, and without that sense of integrity, without the sense that the people showing up in front of court know that they're going to get a fair shake, if there's a question of that, I think you do have to step aside.
So you're not opposed to a standard that's fixed, like the one Justice Bradley had, and there are several other third degree of kinship.
We're not against a per se disqualification standard. I don't know. And about the dollar amount of $1,000, $10,000, or $50,000 that they're looking at in Nevada, I don't know, and I don't mean to punt to you guys, but
you're punting to us.
I'm punting to you guys.
All right.
I don't know enough sports terminology to know whether I've received the pass or anyway, but anyway, we'll take, my Packer friend here will help me. Well, your red light is on. Any other questions?
Yes.
Yes, Justice Brasser.
Mr. Skaggs described Justice at Stake as an umbrella organization.
Correct. What that means is that we are a hub of 55 other groups around the country, grassroots groups that work on different issues in each different state. And so we represent a grassroots coalition where people can get together and talk and share their experiences in different states.
Okay. And you indicated that the Brennan Center is one of the spokes from your hub.
Correct. They're a partner. And we publish reports with them. Our biannual Money and Politics report is co-authored with them.
And is the League of Women Voters Judicial Independence Project one of the spokes?
The League of Women Voters is, I don't know. I know the League of Women Voters in Wisconsin is. I don't know about that. Is it a national project with the League? And I don't know. I don't know it, but I can find out.
On your website of Justice at Stake, it indicates that the League of Women Voters Judicial Independence Project is one of your partners. And the witness this morning indicated that the Wisconsin League of Women Voters is linked to the League of Women Voters Judicial Independence Project. Any dispute about that?
No, I agree. If it's on the website, I just don't
and
know it offhand.
Is the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign one of your partners?
They are.
All right. And is Common Cause one of your partners?
I think so.
Okay. Is Wisconsin Citizen Action one of your partners?
I don't know off the top of my head.
Well, I mean, it's on your website. If your website says they
yes,
are.
Yes, I'm sorry, I don't.
Do you have any conservative partners?
I think the Campaign Legal Center in Washington is a I think, considered a conservative group. I don't know the makeup of every partner group. I'm sorry.
How do you classify the league?
Not conservative.
Concerned citizens, I guess.
Concerned citizens, right. I think we're a grassroots coalition of folks that are concerned about judicial impartiality. So,
where do you get the bulk of your funding?
We are funded by a number of foundations, including OSI, including the Joyce Foundation, the Jet Foundation, and a number of others. And I don't know the rest of them offhand, but I can get that information for you.
Would it be fair to say that either directly or indirectly, George Soros provides a lot of money for Justice at Stake?
I don't. The Open Society Institute, I think, is sponsored by Mr. Soros, so I know we get some money from them. I don't know how that works, but we certainly get money from OSI.
Okay, and the Brennan Center, too.
I believe so.
And the League of Women Voters Judicial Independence Project.
I don't know.
Well, that was part of the testimony this morning.
Right.
There's sort of an echo chamber here. What is your position on appointment of judges? I mean, if we went to your website and examined the website and the policy positions you've staked out, would you prefer to see judges appointed?
That is not the position of Justice at Stake. Justice at Stake has certainly supported states that have merit selection or retention elections. We've supported states that have judicial elections. We work to reform what we see, to keep courts fair and impartial. We've worked with states that have the Missouri plan to help improve the way they implement that. We've worked with states that have elections to try to help them improve that and keep courts fair and impartial with both elections and merit selection with retention elections.
Would it be fair to say that you're interested in judicial independence?
I think we're interested in judicial independence, judicial impartiality, and fairness of the judiciary, correct?
Okay. Well, what do people do in a state where justices are elected if they don't think that the justices are impartial?
What do people do?
No.
I think they vote them out of office.
Okay. But you want to kind of limit what they do, what are their tools to vote them out of office?
No, I think what our purpose is to help courts maintain a reputation of fairness and impartiality.
Well, if you support public funding of campaigns?
We have in North Carolina, and I think we support the Wisconsin resolution as well.
Do you support the impartial justice
yes.
legislation in Wisconsin?
Yes.
Isn't there a $1,000 contribution limit in Wisconsin?
In a primary election, yes.
I beg pardon?
$100,000 in a primary?
No. I mean, what an individual can do in terms of a contribution, isn't it $1,000?
Correct. To get the public funding.
Okay. So that's really a limiting speech, isn't it?
I don't think anyone's required to take public financing if that bill passes. I think it's not a requirement to do the system.
Well, if someone had to recuse themselves from if they received more than $1,000
under the league's I don't know what the answer whether 1,000 or 10,000 or 50,000. I don't know what the answer to that number is for per se disqualification rule.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Let me just ask you, I'm here and if I hear you correctly, although your written material does not take a position on any of these petitions, you don't seem to favor a flat amount. Is that right?
No, I think we would favor a flat amount. We don't have a position on which flat amount is
okay.
best suited for Wisconsin.
Now, is it so any of your organizations or spokes or drops in the umbrella, they can take any position they want?
Correct.
They can take a position opposed to you?
Correct.
You can take a position opposed to them?
Correct.
And you obviously do?
Right. So, right.
That's okay within?
It's okay. We're a grassroots coalition to exchange information. It's not, there's no requirement.
Don't bind each other.
There's no binding agreements between any of us.
Umbrella has a few holes.
Say again?
The umbrella has a few holes.
It's I guess it's not an umbrella. It's more of a bicycle wheel. There's spokes.
All right. Thank you, Mr. Robinson. And
thank you for coming.
And participating and sending the written materials. The next person is Michael McCabe, Wisconsin Democracy Campaign. Mr. McCabe.
Thank you, Madam Chief Justice. And
maybe before you start, let me ask this question. Are you now or have you ever been affiliated with the Open Society?
Because that question was asked this morning during the lunch break, I actually went back and did some checking, and I'd like to share some information with you that I think is pertinent to this question, because I take some exception to the premise underlying that question.
I withdraw that question, and I apologize. I was just surprised that the question,
I'd like
you're right,
to,
it shouldn't be coming from the bench of the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and I apologize.
But, you know, I went back and checked, and the League of Women Voters at the national level does get OSI money, as does Justice at Stake and Brennan Center, but so does the American Bar Association and the National Center for State Courts and UNICEF and American Cancer Society and American Red Cross. And Yale University, and Harvard, and Columbia, and Johns Hopkins, and Princeton, and all of these institutions.
Why didn't you mention the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
And all of these institutions are bound by federal law. They cannot advance the personal political agenda of Mr. George Soros. Open Society Institute is bound by federal law. It cannot advance the personal agenda of George Soros, or it risks losing its tax-exempt status. and having its doors closed. And any of the recipients, including all of those that I mentioned from the American Bar Association to Harvard University, they cannot seek to elect or engage in electioneering activity to advance Mr. Soros' agenda, or they will have violated federal law. And that's a point that needs to be taken into consideration within the context of that question. I want to say, first of all, I want to thank you for holding this hearing and for inviting the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign to offer comments. We've offered written comments, which you have, and so I won't seek to cover that territory, but rather would like to elaborate on some of the key points. And I'd particularly like to go over each of the first three petitions that were brought to the court. I was not able to see Justice Bablich's petition in advance of today's hearing, but I did see the other three, and I'd like to offer some additional remarks. But I want to start by saying that the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign is not agnostic on the question of whether judges should be elected or appointed in Wisconsin. We favor elections, and in fact have been outspoken critics of proposals to move toward an appointed judiciary in our state. We do favor reform of those judicial elections in Wisconsin, but we by no means favor a movement toward an appointed judiciary. And if there are others who favor that position, they do so without the support of the Wisconsin Democracy Campaign, and in fact will encounter stiff opposition from our organization. Former Justice Bablich made reference on a number of occasions to the growing public concern about the perception on the part of the public that the independence of our judicial branch in Wisconsin is increasingly suspect. And Adam Skaggs showed that there is actually public opinion research that supports Justice Bablich's contention. I'd like to put an even finer point on that finding. The 2008 poll done by the national firm American Viewpoint, some of the findings were mentioned by Mr. Skaggs. One thing he didn't note was that survey of Wisconsin residents found that only 5% of the people surveyed believe that campaign contributions to judges do not influence decisions. 5%. And a later poll that same year found that nearly half of Wisconsin residents now believe that judges' decisions are based on politics and special interest pressure. And that's why this is such an incredibly important issue for you to encounter and confront. And that's why I applaud you for undertaking the task of examining when the financing of judicial campaigns should result in a judge's disqualification from sitting on a case. Having said that, I'd like to start with the petition by Wisconsin Manufacturers and Commerce and offer some brief comments expanding on what's already been discussed today. I think that the thrust of WMC's petition is inconsistent with and contradicts the U.S. Supreme Court's finding in Caperton v. Massey. And saying that significant spending on a judicial campaign should not alone, or should not solely, is the word that's been used, result in mandatory recusal is wholly unhelpful, because it strains the boundaries of common sense to conclude that the U.S. Supreme Court in Caperton looked at anything except $3 million worth of spending by a single individual as the sole reason why
Counselor, I think you read Caperton in too limited a fashion. They also specifically said the case was pending at the time the contributions were made. It wasn't something that was going to come up in 2 years, and I believe the leagues would give the judge 2 years to get off a case. I think that Caperton was far more detailed than just the dollar amount. Having said that, the dollar amount is enough to shock the conscience, so you can see how they got into due process because the case was pending. Now, I wonder, would they have come out in the same place if the dollar amounts were the same, there was nothing pending, and this business with Massey Cole wasn't even in the trial court, but came up 2 years later? I bet you they wouldn't have.
Well, that's a good question, but it's impossible to imagine that the court would have landed where it landed had it not been for the dollar amount
was gigantic. Yeah,
exactly.
I agree. It was a tremendous factor. I agree.
And so I think a rule that does make campaign expenditures, campaign contributions alone cause for recusal is something very worthy of your consideration. And I go back to the issue of public perception of the independence and fairness and impartiality of judges. If 5% of the people in the state believe that campaign contributions do not influence decisions, that is a crisis of confidence that screams out to be addressed. And
well, so is the fact that only 18% of the people in the state even bother to get out and cast a vote.
Agreed.
I wonder if you would address my question to a prior speaker, and that is, if we buy a per se limit, whatever limit the court may end up thinking is okay, one person can knock out a justice and cause recusal because of that. What about all the other people who voted for that justice, who were part of the meager 18%, but they got out and vote. They gave nothing, which is what most voters do, by the way, or they gave $5 or they gave $10. They don't have that justice sitting on a case that is of statewide concern. The result of that case will affect them in some way, or we wouldn't be taking the case if it weren't of statewide concern. What about disenfranchising them from their right to have that particular justice? Hear that issue. I think you focus on the case, so did Caperton in all fairness, but it's really the issues that we take the cases for. We don't care who brings them up. We look at the issues.
Granted, but the other side of that same coin...
Well, I want you to address my side of that coin, the side of the coin that I questioned you about.
I can't address your side of the coin without addressing the other.
Well, start with my side. Because, I'm a little greedy. You only have 10 minutes.
Because it cuts to the core of the balancing act that you have to engage in. Agreed. If contributions result in mandatory recusal, people who have elected you to hear cases of statewide importance will not have you listening to that case. But if you sit on the case and the vast majority of the public perceives the ruling to have been influenced by campaign contributions, then how is the public interest been served? And how have all those voters been served? So you are left with a balancing test that you have to wrestle with. I don't mean to diminish the difficulty of striking the proper balance, but again, if you remain silent on the importance of campaign contributions to the perception of the court as independent and fair and impartial, then I think you will increasingly, as campaign expenses accelerate, you'll increasingly leave the court in a position of issuing rulings under a cloud of doubt, a cloud of suspicion that in fact the court's judgment has been bent by significant sums of money that have flowed into election campaigns. And so that is a very tricky balancing act, which I guess I was going to address the realtors next, but maybe I should
speed up and see.
But maybe I should just jump to some thoughts about the League of Women Voters petition. While we agree with the general thrust of the petition, that there is a need for recusal reform, that there ought to be a threshold established, We are not comfortable with some elements of the petition. I would recommend, first of all, that perhaps a more nuanced approach to establishing a threshold is worthy of your consideration. Maybe it's worthwhile to look at the difference between the Supreme Court and other courts, but more importantly, I think looking at the whole picture and the percentage, perhaps the percentage of support that particular contributions or spending represent in a campaign is something certainly worthy of consideration if you craft such a rule. And then I think it's extremely important to take a look at you know, I've had a fair amount of involvement with in discussions in the development of both rules and proposed legislation here in Wisconsin, familiar with federal law in this area. And I would urge you to take into consideration the structure of some of those proposals, particularly with respect to a media exemption and with respect to member-to-member communication exemptions. Those have routinely been written into proposals that have been offered in proposed legislation, and they were addressed in McCain-Feingold at the federal level. You need not be as broad in describing electioneering communications as the League's petition would suggest.
You don't like a totality of circumstances or just a reasonable person approach?
Well, I think it's valuable to establish an objective threshold, but I think that threshold ought to take into consideration factors that go beyond simply a dollar limit, such as the proportion that certain financial support represents in a campaign. If the whatever line you draw, whether it was $1,000 or $5,000 or $10,000 or $50,000 or $500,000.
Or 5% or 10%.
You know, regardless what the number is, you know, if it represents a fraction of 1% of the support a candidate has, that's relevant. Whereas if that same amount of financial support represents a quarter or a third of one's financial support, that too is a factor that we ought to be sensitive to. And it certainly would have a bearing on the public's perception of a judge's ability to sit on a case and rule fairly and impartially.
Maybe in a court that a justice cannot be replaced, maybe we ought to have no rules on recusal and say you got to sit on every case. That's what you're elected to do, and that's what you should do. Never mind if it's your brother that's arguing it or the third of kin, which I never understood anyway. You know, that's what they voted for us to do. We're going to be fair and square. What do you think of that? Saves a lot of trouble.
It saves a lot of trouble, but it still leaves the court in a position of ruling on cases and having those rulings issued under a cloud of suspicion that this judge ought not have heard that case and ruled on it, or this judge had no business doing this because of a financial and political conflict of interest. And you know, times have changed. We are in an environment that didn't exist just a few short years ago in Wisconsin. And I think there's a conspicuous missing piece in recusal rules as a result, because times have changed, but the rules remain as they were in that bygone era.
Mr. McCabe, what once? I'm sorry, Justice Prosser, go ahead.
Mr. McCabe, there has been a lot of discussion here about the reputation of the court, of the perception of the court, public's perception of the court. Haven't you personally played a major role in shaping the public's perception of the Wisconsin Supreme Court?
I would take a more modest view of my
contributions in the area. I suppose I should just accept it as flattery, but look, I see the same concerns that lead to these kinds of public opinion research findings. I'm, as a member of the public, as a citizen in the state, I've watched how judicial election campaigns have changed. I've watched the political environment change. I've watched the sort of the partisanization of judicial politics. All of those things deeply trouble me. I'm not, I'd be the last person to stand before you and say that I have no opinion on this matter.
Wouldn't you like to see a change in the composition of the Wisconsin Supreme Court? And haven't you actively worked for that change?
Oh, no. No, we
you don't want to see a change in the composition of the court?
We don't engage in any electioneering activity whatsoever. We don't endorse candidates. We don't do any campaign advertising. We track the money
in
politics.
Well, let me just ask you some specific questions. On June 17th of this year, didn't you write a column that implied that I was participating in the Scott Jensen case?
I don't recall the exact date, but in the past, we have raised concerns about your willingness, Your Honor, to serve as a character.
And there wasn't a shred of truth to that column, was there? There wasn't a shred of truth to that column, was there?
There certainly was at one point, and when...
There was not a shred of truth in that, because I have never participated in any appellate aspect of the Scott Jensen case. You put that column out there, you tried to destroy my reputation, and it was totally false.
We have, and it's been reported in the media, and we have pointed out that you had agreed to serve as a character witness for Mr. Jensen.
That is not what I'm talking about, and you know that's not what I'm talking about. You implied in a column on June 17th of this year that I was participating in the Scott Jensen appeal, and that was totally false. Isn't that true?
I simply said in that column that there were members of this court who should not sit on that case. We didn't know who was sitting on that case.
Well, certainly, we did know who was sitting on this case because the orders said that I was not participating.
I didn't see the order.
Well, then you didn't look.
And
it's reckless disregard of the truth. Isn't that basically it?
No, I disagree. We said that there were members of this court who should not sit and hear Mr. Jensen's appeal. And when the court alerted us to the fact that you were not
we
the very next day put that out.
Yeah, and then you attacked me in the correction, didn't you?
I don't believe
yes, you did. Now don't misrepresent anything to the court. Haven't you called me a thief in your columns? Haven't you called me a thief?
Absolutely not.
Didn't you say I stole from the public?
I don't believe I have ever called you a thief.
Well, didn't you say I stole from the public?
I don't believe so.
Well, I could cite you the precise column. Didn't you say that I would have to withdraw from the case involving Justice Ziegler because I had contributed money to her campaign? $250. Didn't you say that?
We pointed out that you had contributed to Justice Ziegler's
and
campaign.
And I had Earth to Prosser, get off the case. You can't sit in this case. Isn't that what you said?
Don't recall the exact words, but we certainly believe that you should have gotten off that case.
It seems to me that there probably is some concern about the Wisconsin Supreme Court, and a lot of it is tied directly to you by misrepresenting things and exaggerating things. I don't know why I should give you any credence.
You give me far greater credit than I probably deserve.
I don't you deserve any debt.
We stand by our concerns about the cases you question. I certainly do not back away from that one inch.
Where can I read all this interesting stuff? That's fine. I think his red light is on anyway. Okay.
Did you kind of suggest humorously that people might consider poisoning Justice Ziegler?
I don't know where you get this.
Well,
they can't kill her, can they? November 20th, 2007.
But that was a reaction to what others were suggesting.
What do you think the implication of your column is? It's just reckless out there.
I don't think that given the concerns that the people have, that they see our positions as reckless.
Do any further questions? Thank you for your appearance, Mr. McCabe, and thank you for your comments on the Wisconsin Democracy campaign. The next three speakers represent the State Bar of Wisconsin. The first is Douglas Kammer, President. Mr. Kammer.
Please the court.
We'll take you one at a time unless you want to speak in unison. All right. Then one at a time. Thank you.
Judge, I intend to yield the floor almost immediately to Mr. Schoberg Curran. I will be very, very brief in my remarks. The State Bar has been watching the Caperton case with great interest, of course. Long before it became something that the public was particularly interested in. It has almost comic book facts, of course. It's very interesting to watch it develop. But we appointed a group to study it. Bill Curran and Tom Schober were part of that group, and they will speak to you in some detail about it momentarily. Our group, the Board of Governors, reviewed at least the first two of these petitions. According to my memory, according to my notes, we reviewed all three, but I don't, quite frankly, don't remember the Manufacturers and Commerce petition. Perhaps it came in some later materials. It came up for vote before the board, and the board unanimously urged the group to vote against and to urge the court to vote against all three of the petitions. I can't tell you that all 52 or so members of the board were bothered by the same aspects of each petition, but each member of the board was bothered by some aspect of each of the petitions. And so we're urging you to take a close look at this and study it before you do anything rash. With that, I hope you won't ask me any questions.
We have your name and address, Mr. Cameron.
You do have indeed. But I can assure you that Mr. Schober and Curran are ready to answer even your most difficult questions. And all those that nobody could answer this morning, feel free to direct them at them. With that, I yield to them, if that's all right with you.
Thank you very much for your appearance, Mr. Schober. Oh, yes. Just state your name and the for whom you're appearing, and Mr. Curran will do the same. Judge Curran.
No.
You're the different Curran.
Judge Curran once removed.
Okay.
Thank you, Your Honor. Good afternoon, Your Honors, and thank you for allowing us to come today to speak to you about this very serious problem. Excuse me. My name is Thomas Schober. I am the chairman of the Judicial Independence Committee of the Board of Governors of the State Bar. With me is William Curran, who is the liaison from the Board of Governors to the Bench and Bar Committee. As you can see from the number of people that are here today, including Tom Basting, a past president of the Board of Governors, our current president, Two of the current Board of Governor members, our executive director, and several staffers. The State Bar has quite an interest in this whole problem. And we've been dealing with this for a couple of years as the Caperton case developed. It all came to a head really last spring at one of our annual meetings in June when past President Diane Deal appointed or passed the resolution to set up a committee to deal with this problem and provide some information to our members and to provide some help where we can to the court or whatever designees you might have as far as liaising with information, whatever studies you can have, access to our staff, that sort of thing. We were fascinated to listen today to the other reactions to the petitions. As you know, our position has been that we would recommend or ask the court to consider dismissing the two petitions that were here first from the League of Women Voters and from the Board of Realtors. I think I cannot speak for the board. As Mr. Kammer has said, the vote on that position was taken at our September meeting. It was unanimous, and it was not just a pass-through. There was a fairly healthy discussion among the Board of Governors. There was a redrafting of that particular resolution. The language has changed, and I think I can speak freely in saying that the Board of Governors and the State Bar pretty much would unanimously agree that those two petitions have merit individually, but they don't solve the problem. There's a much larger problem out there right now that you have to deal with and we all have to deal with in our practices. Our concern is that we know that the American Bar Association is currently revising their preliminary drafts on judicial recusal, and we expect some form of final ruling or report later this year, hopefully for our December meeting, where we'll consider it. We also know that the Caperton case itself has generated other spin-offs that are out there, and we are very interested in trying to gather the information on that as well and seeing if we can help learn from what is going on around the country and other alternatives that might be presented to the court for its consideration in handling these problems. I am somewhat sensitive to these myself because 2 years ago I was in a judicial election and I felt some pressure from interest groups directly calling me on the phone, and I know how difficult it can only get worse at different levels. My experience and Mr. Curran's is primarily at the trial level, so we don't really see some of these issues that you've had to deal with, like the Donahoe case and some of these other things that have come up and wrestle with these problems. I can assure you that we feel that our judges do need some guidance in how to handle these things, and we don't know exactly how best to do that. Mr. Curran and I were talking about this on the phone last night, and one thing that popped into my head was the old bar ethics coordinator that we had and the ethics opinion that would come up, and you would get at least you had some written documentation that you could rely on, that other people had seen some of these problems and that sort of thing. We don't seem to really have anything other than a couple of the decisions coming out of this court on recusal issues. So anyway, we, just to make a long story short, we are ready to help in any way we can, and we are not suggesting anything in particular for you to do, but we just wanted you all to know that we're kind of in this issue together, and we will do what we can to provide you with whatever support we can.
Mr. Schober, let me ask you, you're asking us to deny the petitions, at least the first two, is that correct?
Yes.
Are you suggesting that there be any sort of study as to how we should address these matters?
Well, we suggested that in our resolution, that the court consider having some form of study to sort of bring all of these issues into focus and discuss them in some rational way before it was forced to decide on one particular method or another. I think there are a lot of issues that came up today that I had never heard of. I've read a lot of this material, and I think it's focused much better for me after listening to all of the people make their presentations today, some of whom were excellent. But I think a lot of them were a little too focused for my way of thinking, and I think we need. I think it's a much larger problem to be dealt with. Honestly, these recusal issues seem to come up in an odd way. We were talking about this at lunch, trying to figure out what the procedure was if you wanted to review a recusal petition. We see it in coming up in some of the cases in kind of an odd way, but there doesn't seem to be any method for someone who's dissatisfied with a trial judge's recusal action to do anything other than file a substitution writ under Section 80158. I just throw that out as something that we weren't able to come to much of a consensus on at lunch, and wondered if that wasn't the sort of thing that the ABA would be recommending looking into down the road and as part of their report. They're also recommending some educational opportunities to sort of come to some consensus on what the rules are and figure out a way of communicating them.
How certain are you that the American Bar Association is going to have a report before the end of the year?
Well, I can't. Let me just check. We're pretty certain. We think it's going to come by the
end.
It's
in the process.
It's in the process.
There's some writings and preliminary reports that have been circulated.
Right. There was a preliminary report that was before the Caperton decision. So my understanding coming from our staffers is that the Caperton decision itself has generated some additional work across the country. And so I imagine, but I think they'd put a timeline on themselves toward the end of the year, if I'm not mistaken. So that's what we're hoping for.
They have their meeting in, what, January, February?
So.
February.
Mm-hmm. And so with that in mind, I realize you've been here a long time today and listened to a lot of information. If there's any questions that I can answer, Mr. Kern is here also to share his thoughts.
I have a question regarding the WMC petition. What, if anything, is your position with regard to whether the court should grant that petition?
I cannot speak for the Bar Association on that petition because that particular petition postdates our meeting in September. I would say that my personal reaction to it would be that it would be handled in the same way as the others, that it be rejected, but that the ideas set forth in there be considered in some larger study that the court might want to conduct.
Several thought it was the status quo. Do you think that's right?
Well, I've been practicing law for 37 years, and I can honestly say that my experience has been excellent with the trial bar, my treatment at the Court of Appeals and Supreme Court level. I have never been able to fault anyone for feeling that my clients were not being receiving fair treatment. I think that the primary focus of all these petitions, it gets back to the basic judgment of the individual judge, and that we rely on that, and that's what we elect all of you for and all of our trial judges. And I do think that we elect people for their integrity and their judgment in the first instance.
Well,
in the short run, I would say, Your Honor, that the rules have held up well until...
Well, when there's a motion about a trial judge and either actual bias or appearance of bias, if the judge doesn't recuse himself or herself, does not, it goes to trial, that issue can be raised right through the appeal. In fact, last night I read a case I had forgotten about for many a year, and it was a Judge Serafin. Milwaukee sat on a criminal case. So those of you will remember Judge Serafin sat on a criminal case, made preliminary rulings on a search and seizure. He told the lawyer, in effect, I appointed you. I've given you cases, and now you turn on me. I may be overstating him, but not much.
No, you're not.
And you now bring all these motions, and you and I know the guy's guilty. Why are you wasting the court's time? The lawyer complained it was not, at least there was an appearance of bias, whether there was actual bias. Interesting thing is the state Supreme Court, I was sitting on the court, said, not good, Judge Serafin. But that it was in preliminary proceedings, and that when he went to trial, the guy got a fair trial. When you looked at it, and he got a fair sentence. And that, so it was harmless error. Seventh Circuit reversed. Said, what do you mean harmless error? It's an interesting case. Judge Posner wrote it. He said, well, we got a due process problem, but we don't have to deal with that. We can deal with it as an ineffective assistance of counsel because the judge was biased against the counsel and or appeared to be biased. We didn't know he was biased. So, I mean, there are procedures. We've gone through this at the trial level. There are ways of handling this. And, of course, there's a peremptory strike if you get there fast
enough. That has been the most effective tool.
Sure.
And we are one of the very few states that have that option as a trial lawyer. Mm-hmm. In fact, we may be the only one.
But we don't have it on the appellate court. And in the Court of Appeals, the judge recuses himself or herself. Another judge can be brought in. Is it effective? Is it efficient? Is it not especially? It requires time and effort, and judicial efficiency drops as a result. But on this court, you cannot substitute. Now, there was a proposal a couple of years ago, I think, to substitute judges up here on a recusal, but that didn't get anywhere. So, you want further study?
Well, yes, Your Honor. I think it would assist the court in being able to iron out some of the answers to some of these questions that have come up today that people probably weren't prepared to respond to today, but are very real, and they are very serious issues of the implementation of whatever rules are being considered. So, yes, I think...
We've got elections coming up in April.
Yes, we do.
Won't have any further guidance if we don't move.
That may be true, but the rules that we have in place have seemed to have worked fairly well in most of our experience for a number of years. So, I, in the short run, I can't see any reason not to continue them. I would not want to rush this and change the rules solely to... accommodate an election schedule in 2010. I think that would be a mistake, particularly given the time lags that we have with some of these other groups that are out there studying this very problem nationwide and may be able to provide some better data for the court in resolving some of these disputes. That's just my take on it, though, and we certainly would defer to the court and its collective wisdom on how best to handle this. That I agree with.
Mr. Curran?
Thank you, Your Honor.
Thank you, Mr. Shulman.
If
I cut you off, I'm sorry. Did you have anything else you wanted to say?
No, Your Honor. Thank you.
My name is William Curran, and I'm from Mauston, Wisconsin, and I, with Tom Schober, am serving on the Board of Governors Committee on Judicial Independence and Recusal. I'm not going to repeat what Tom said, but I would like to call your attention to the last sentence of our resolution. While it's true, and Justice Crooks has mentioned it several times, that the state bar resolution does call for establishing a study committee, we wanted to leave that open-ended. We did not want a study committee to be necessarily narrowly directed. And the last sentence says the court should move deliberately to establish greater guidance to judges through an enumeration of factors judges should consider in potential recusal situations, and to provide training for implementation of new standards. We perceive that as a step below taking any action on mandatory recusal. We perceive that as a matter of guidance. And from listening here today, it seems like one of the difficulties facing the court is you're chasing a kind of a phantom concept of perception. And you're trying to define what is this public perception, and you're trying to define what is this bias that people are perceiving. And, you know, that's been a long-time problem. In the White case, I think Justice Scalia offered three different definitions of bias. And so what you're faced with is two different problems. One problem is how do you address this issue of perception, and how do you get a handle on just what that is? You know, we've all been in cases where we've walked out of the circuit courtroom, and 10 steps ahead of us is our opponent, who turns to his client and said, "The judge was unfair to you." Well, usually they use harsher language than that, but that's the idea.
Cleaned it up, the
correct
event.
Correct. And so the point is that person is going to be biased against that judge and against that court. They're going to feel they didn't get treated fairly. And what we're looking at is a question of a bias that goes beyond that. And so the particular item before you today has to do with financial contributions. And in that narrow concept, we can think that there are ways in which you could have people assist you in a committee form to come up with suggestions as factors, such as some of the issues that the Chief Justice raised at the beginning. When you're talking about amounts, or when you're talking about durations, or when you're talking about this totality of the circumstances, I think that we believe you folks, when you take this oath and say, "I will administer justice without respect to persons and will faithfully and impartially discharge the duties of the office to the best of our ability." And as Justice Ziegler reminded us, that has grown into a legal presumption of impartiality. I don't think that can just be dismissed lightly, but I do think that there are opportunities for the court to make rules that would make it a little bit clearer and give greater guidance to oncoming new justices or existing justices or to judges. Our committee did not get the impression from our 52 Board of Governors members or our statewide committee that there is a significant problem at the trial court level, as Tom told you, because of the two statutes, the civil and the criminal, on substitution. We also didn't get the impression that there is a significant problem at the Court of Appeals level. Ann Kearney's the head of our state bar appellate court section. She indicated that they're seeing, as a section, they're seeing more recusals on the intermediate appellate court level, and that they're being handled relatively smoothly. And she raised the same question that you just did, Chief Justice, and that is the Supreme Court has all these other constitutional problems with what happens when people recuse themselves. And the appellate court's section of the state bar asked that if you do get to the point where you decide you're going to make some rules on mandatory recusal or mandatory disqualification, that they then have an opportunity to work with our committee, to work with you, to try to figure out what all this other second tier of problems is going to be and how those would be resolved.
Mr. Kern, what is the name of, quote, our committee that you're talking about? Does it have a name?
Interesting. I think it's called the Judicial Independence Committee.
And it's the Judicial Independence Committee of the Board of Governors?
Of the Board of Governors, okay. Of the State Bar of Wisconsin.
Thank you.
And so, in conclusion, we think that developing some guidance might be a good, healthy first step in assisting the judge and justices without necessarily any change in the judicial code of conduct as it would have to do with mandatory recusal.
Give me an example. What do you mean?
If somebody is faced with a, if a justice is faced with a petition for recusal, it's my understanding now that that is handled by that particular justice. And that particular justice then has to weigh certain factors mm-hmm. to determine whether or not the standard is met, that even though they don't think it's bias, it might have an obvious appearance of bias
sure.
that they'd want to avoid.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Where do they go to know any collective wisdom as to what other people have thought is an appropriate duration? That was one of the things that Tom and I kind of gleaned the most from today's discussion, is there isn't really any consensus. Is duration 1 year or is duration 10 years? What is an adequate amount that should be involved? $1,000, $10,000, $50,000, $500,000? And so I don't know that there's going to be answers, but if there can even be milestones or yardsticks that could be put out to determine, and of course, you know, we've got the 40 questions from Justice Roberts. I'm not anticipating that the committee could answer the 40 questions, but might be able to make some progress in that regard. And I would just, I was just pro-offering that as a step of a judicial education or judicial process that wouldn't necessarily go to the step of voting for mandatory recusal.
Got it. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you, Mr. Curran. Thank you, Mr. Silber.
Thank you.
And thank you, President Kammer, for the views of the State Bar of Wisconsin. My last speaker is Attorney Brady Williamson, representing the multiple groups in support of 08, 25, and 9-10. Ms. Nodolf, is that the last speaker? Okay. Mr. Williamson.
Thank you, Chief Justice. My name is Brady Williamson with Dr. Khan, and I'm here this afternoon on behalf of the dozen or so groups that have endorsed both the Realtors petition and the WMC petition. These groups have disparate memberships. They have disparate goals. They use disparate means to reach those disparate goals, but they have, for purposes of today, two things in common. They all participate in the political life of this state. They've done that for a long time, and they will continue to do that for a long time. The other thing they have in common is uncertainty. And it's an uncertainty about the relationship between their involvement in the political life of this state and their participation as litigants, as amicus on behalf of their members, in the judicial processes of the state. And that uncertainty, which has been latent, has accelerated because of Caperton, which, by the way, I think Caperton was rightly decided. But this is not a phantom concept. This is real. In courts, courthouses around this state, recusal is a more and more frequent occurrence. Motions for recusal. And rather than approach this from the standpoint of a justice of this court, or from the standpoint of the leadership of the groups I represent, let me take a variation on Justice Rogensack's suggestion and approach this from the standpoint of a lawyer who practices in Langlade County. And that lawyer has had a long practice there. He knows the judge, not well, they're not social friends, but he knows the judge. He thinks this individual is a good judge and that he ought to be reelected next spring in Langlade County. The lawyer thinks so highly of this judge and his importance, his role in the county, that he'd like to make a contribution. He'd like to suggest to his clients and friends that they make a contribution, and that if they're so disposed, they leaflet, they call their friends, they talk at civics clubs about the reason this is a good judge, and we want this judge to stay on the bench. We want him to stay for six more years. So what does that lawyer do? Does he individually say, I'm going to write a check, I'm going to endorse, I'm going to do a letter to the editor? Does he tell his clients to do that? And I would think the answer to that question is not clear anymore. Because if that lawyer is conscientious, he's going to be concerned that a legal, publicly disclosed, modest, in the world of Langlade County or any other county, contribution could have an untoward effect on this lawyer's ability to have the elected judge hear cases that he brings before his, for his clients, or that he defends. And I think this threat of recusal motions is very significant.
Counsel, let me challenge you on that for a moment, if I may. And that is, if I were a lawyer, I think I in Langley County, I think rather than going through a hassle of a motion for recusal, I would use the substitution statute if I were on the other side to get rid of the judge. Indeed, the presenters before you, if I were on the other side of the contributing attorney, indeed the presenters before you have suggested from their contacts that they don't perceive much of a problem at the trial level or court of appeals level on this issue. Is there a problem?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And the reason is that, I think you'll find this in a footnote in the realtor's brief, 40% of the counties in this state, 40% of the counties in this state are one-judge counties.
17.
And the whole purpose, if we believe the framers of our Constitution, of electing judges, is so that the people of the county at the trial level will have a choice of who is going to sit on them. And you know, Justice Bradley, it might be that the folks in Langley County would be perfectly happy to have the judge from Iron County or the next county over sit on their case. But if it had to be a judge from Dane County, perish the thought, they might have a totally different view. They elected this judge.
Mr. Williamson, you want certainty. So, under the present procedure, the lawyer kicks in $25. Now, I haven't checked to see how much it costs to run in Langlade County or Pierce or Pepin or any number of other one-judge counties. No media market TV, usually, just radio. TV would be way out of the particular range and cover a lot of people that aren't going to vote in the county. So maybe this whole election was going to cost $1,000, maybe. And the lawyer kicks in $25. Under the present system, where do you get certainty under either of the provisions that you espouse, your people espouse? You don't have certainty, because solely the $25 should not kick them out. But it's a totality of the circumstances, right?
You've raised 2 points, Your Honor. The first is the $25 in the context of Langlade County might trigger a recusal motion if the judge, to get himself reelected in his campaign, has only spent a very small amount. And I think it was either Justice Ruggensack or Justice Prosser who asked, does the level of the bench, if you will, matter? And it does matter, but not in the way you think, because a $999 contribution to a campaign for an appellate judge in the context of a 1.5 million election is one thing. But a small contribution in the context of a $5,000 campaign might be significant.
Okay, well, that's my point, that your procedures are a totality of the circumstances. Those are the two particular petitions you are espousing. Totality of the circumstances never gives certainty, because you don't know how someone else is going to gauge those totalities. If you want certainty, you put in a flat amount. I know you don't want a flat amount, but that's certain.
But, Your Honor, we do want a flat amount, and it's the amount provided by state law, which varies by the height, if you will, of the bench. You know, Chief Justice, you said, okay, what about the company who has 20 executives, if I think I got your numbers right, 20 executives who each give $10,000?
I'm talking about an appellate race, of course.
Right.
Because the others would be violating the state law.
Right. And in that particular case, There may be other reasons coupled with that $200,000 aggregated contribution that lead a conscientious judge to recuse herself. But we do provide certainty with these two rules because it takes a whole set of problems off the board, perceived problems. If these two rules, and particularly the realtor's rule, were in effect, Donahue would not have come to this court. And I am suggesting to you...
Why not?
Because as I read Donahue, Your Honor, the issue was contributions and endorsements by counsel. And this court said in Donahue, quite accurately, there is no case in Wisconsin, I'm quoting, or elsewhere, that requires recusal of a judge or justice based solely on a contribution to a campaign. That's the language that this court used to quite appropriately discourage recusals in that case and in cases like that. But what's lacking is clarity. And by either of these, and certainly both of these proposed rules, we're just going to take a burden, you would be, the court would be, taking a burden off the shoulders of trial judges, appellate judges, but of no less importance, litigators, and people that advise their clients on their involvement in the political life of this state.
Counsel, your prior presenters from the state bar indicated that the 52 members of the Board of Governors unanimously asked that we study this and deny your petition. Respond to whenever anyone does something unanimously, that's of a little impressive to me. And so you've
got... It always makes me suspicious.
Thank you. Well, okay. I'll take that into account when you have your next case up here.
I thank you.
Just try to oblige whatever the rest of them are doing. So should we give some weight to that? And if not, why not?
It's the easy answer, and it's the wrong answer. You have four petitions in front of you. Here's one way to look at those four in the aggregate. Two of the petitions propose a rather extended set of rules on when a judge must recuse. Two of the petitions, the ones we support, propose a very simple, straightforward rule for when a judge need not recuse. We will never, and nor should we ever be, able to get into the mind of a judge. And if a judge, trial, appellate, supreme, feels uncomfortable sitting on a case, for any reason, she or he shouldn't sit on the case. I think a lot about the rules of recusal needs study, but not this part. I think that Caperton has called into question the continuing validity of American television, for better or worse. And Chief Justice, let me come back to your point about totality of the circumstances. That test is a due process test. So that when we take your 20 times $10,000, $200,000, if in context that gets us to the due process issue.
Does it have to be extreme?
Fine. Depends. It depends. But we're talking about guidance for lawyers, litigants, clients, judges in the mine run of cases.
Justice Rodens, I've had a question.
Yeah, I just want to be sure I understand your position. What I'm perceiving is that you'd like us to grant the petition 09, 10, and 11, which is the realtors. No, that's not right. The realtors is 08, 26. So you want us to grant 08, 26, and 09, 10, which is the position propounded by WMC. And then you think this issue is very complicated. You don't want us to refer it to a study group, but you're not opposed to the bars looking at this and maybe making guideline kind of suggestions to help a judge as he or she decides if he should step aside? No. You just want us to adopt those two,
deny the other two and be done?
Correct.
Okay. But, right, just so I know what you're asking.
But, Your Honor, there is, we cannot stand or sit here today in the shadow of Caperton and say that the world of recusal jurisprudence is unchanged. I mean, look, I think an argument can be made that there ought to be, using an example, an advisory panel of retired judges or justices to whom a judge, trial or appellate, mm-hmm. could go to for advice, confidential, if she has a question about recusal. I think the conundrum that leaves you at six or four when there are legitimate recusals is something that has to be addressed. Because as a number of members of this court have observed, it's not simply, oh, I don't get the judge I want. In the case of this court, you know, without meaning to flatter anybody, there are only seven of you. And there's no replacement. And in some states, there is. In some states, there's a mechanism that if a judge on a seven-person court recuses or is ill, that another judge, justice, takes his or her place temporarily. Now, that requires a constitutional change. That requires study. I think having the bar's input on that would be terrific. Maybe the question of recusal is something the Judicial Commission should be consulted on as well. You know, I think recusal is such a thorny question that a trial judge, whether it's in Antigo or Mauston, ought to have some resources on. And what we're saying in terms of asking for these two petitions to be granted now is to just take this whole Donahue set of issues off the table. So the judge in Langlade County, up for election next April, knows that if he gets a contribution, it's not going to trigger motions. I mean, you know, lawyers, not just the ones that you...
Gets a contribution that solely won't trigger, but it still might trigger.
Well, if there are other factors, Your Honor, sure.
What's the matter with having a rule that says a judge shall be required to recuse himself or herself in a proceeding or when the judge has any endorsement or the judge's campaign committee receives a lawful campaign contribution, which under the totality of the circumstances might reasonably, his or her impartiality might reasonably be questioned, and I'm not interested in an analysis of my syntax. I'm interested in an analysis of my goal of stating positively that the totality of the circumstances of any contribution to be considered, and in terms of Caperton, that the impartiality is objectively examined.
It would be better than what we have today, mm-hmm. which is a vacuum or worse. But I think, Chief, it unnecessarily puts due process into play.
Puts what?
Puts due process into play when it need not be. I mean, not just the lawyers who have appeared before you today, but lawyers across the state, you know, zealously advocate their client's cause. And if getting a different judge, having waived or having used your 801-58 right mm-hmm. to substitute, you know, there are some judges I'd rather have than other judges. And if I'm zealously advocating for my client, if I can find a reason to get a different judge, I will. I would argue I think I have an ethical duty to do that.
Justice Crooks.
Mr. Williamson, you touched a few minutes ago on something that I tried to get at earlier this morning. You said that you thought that Caperton had called into question the American TV case. And certainly that calls into play 75719, which involves basically a subjective test.
Only as to G.
Right, as to G. But do you not think that given that uncertainty that's developed based on Caperton, based on American TV, based on the statute, that we ought not to take a serious look at whether or not the objective standard in the code, the judicial code, ought also to apply to 75719G?
Yes, you should. But the perfect shouldn't be the enemy of the good here, Justice Crooks. These two proposals, the realtors and WMC, give this court an opportunity now, in advance of April, not to mention in advance of a year from April, to simply prevent problems, to prevent a wave of recusal motions that are going to be based on contributions. You know, this state, thanks to the efforts of a lot of people, has pretty good disclosure laws. And if I want to know what someone gave to a candidate for judge, certainly for Supreme Court, there are a number of databases I can get to in maybe a minute and a half.
And you can search them?
Yes, and I can find out which lawyers, which litigants have given to candidates. And of course, some candidates for this court are, even the unsuccessful candidates, often are still sitting on cases, so they're still subject to the recusal rules as well, based on contributions.
Could I follow up Justice Crook's question? Could you spell out really precisely what you mean by Caperton affecting the American TV? What, just a nice law professor type answer.
American television held that the decision to recuse rests solely with the judge being asked to recuse, subject only to review, to ensure that the judge went through a logical mental process, whether it took 5 minutes, 5 hours, or 5 days, to reach the recusal decision. Caperton, for the very first time, provided an objective measure, an objective check on that decision. Not just the judge thought about it and thought about it and thought about it and said, I'm going to stay on, but that the circumstances there were so egregious that Justice Kennedy, writing for the majority, said that due process required that the Supreme Court of the United States reverse that decision. You know, we talked about all the numbers, Justice Rogenczak, the $1,000 to the candidate, the independent spending. But in the record of the Caperton case were some pretty outrageous non-financial issues.
Right.
Like the picture on the back of the yacht, and so forth. And I think Caperton was right. I mean, I also think Chief Justice Roberts was right in his list of 40 questions. He should have at least pointed out that you all would have to answer those 40 questions because the federal bench doesn't have to deal with that. But it was extreme in the circumstance. But I think it's important to acknowledge that there is now an objective component. You know, with all respect to the State Bar or any other group, it's not them that's going to be deciding how to apply Caperton to real-world facts. You are. And one reason that the two petitions with which I'm most familiar focused on the code, Chief Justice, rather than 757, was first of all because one of the petitions was pre-Caperton, and second, precisely because we thought, as advocates, that amending the code could be done more quickly, more efficiently, and send a more specific message to the trial judges of this state and the lawyers and litigants who appear before them that this category, legal campaign contributions, was not crippling, that the fact of a legal campaign contribution or endorsement, and Justice Prosser, I think, mentioned a newspaper endorsement, an open records case, same problem. But that the exercise of free speech, and by the way, this gets back to where I began with our not hypothetical judge in Langlade County, if that lawyer and his clients decide they're not going to participate in the campaign, then we're all the worse for it.
Let me ask this. After Caperton, let's say I were an attorney arguing a case in the United States Supreme Court. You've probably done it. Have you?
Yes.
All right. How many times?
Twice.
All right. Let's suppose you're in your third case in the United States Supreme Court, and you don't think Justice Scalia should sit in the case. You file a motion of some sort, i.e. move that Justice Scalia recuse himself because, and in your view, that adds up to due process. What will happen in the United States Supreme Court?
Well, I hope I wouldn't bring the motion, Justice Prosser, in light of the unsuccessful effort to disqualify Justice Scalia for going duck hunting with the Vice President.
Which decision Justice Scalia authored?
Yes, exactly.
Yes.
Thank you for the punchline, Justice Rogenczak. So,
but wasn't that pre-Caperton? I mean, how does this change the landscape? Are you saying that, say, 5 members of the United States Supreme Court can remove a justice from the court against his will in a particular case?
Yes.
Does that make any sense to you?
If the circumstances, Justice Prosser, were so egregious, but of course we don't have the financial component in U.S. Supreme Court.
Money is spent on nominations and consent of the Senate. That issue adds in the belt way. You've got units lobbying, and I don't say there's a quid pro quo when you deal with the senators, but if there's financial support there, and then they say on their way out, and I hope you will not vote for the current nominee, you got money. There's lots of money.
Absolutely.
I mean, it's in direct or indirect ways. Doesn't the Supreme Court have to deal with due process of its own members? We don't know because there's no particular case since Caperton.
And the case of Caperton was not a Supreme Court justice dealing with another Supreme Court justice, but rather the Supreme Court dealing with the Supreme Court of a state, correct? I don't know of any case where a Supreme Court justice was where it was decided upon by the brethren that a Supreme Court justice should not sit on a U.S. Supreme Court case.
I'm not either, Justice Rogan.
Well, what about Justice Douglas? When Justice Douglas had a stroke, his brethren, not in open public court, but in closed conference, his brethren said, when Justice Douglas's vote is key on a 5-4, we're going to re-argue the case when there is no Justice Douglas. That vote was 7-1, with Justice White saying, can't do that. So there is precedent on the United States Supreme Court for disqualifying its own.
But it was based on physical incompetence to hear the case. Nothing to do with what we are talking about, where no one has ever raised the mental capacity of a judge. We're talking about judges that are presumed to be competent We're talking about undue influence on their ability to handle a case, correct?
Absolutely. And of course, members of this court and members of the U.S. Supreme Court have recused themselves because of, of investments, because of familial ties, which, by the way, I haven't been asked, but I'll make an advertisement. I think judges generally should explain why they're not sitting on a case. I think that helps credibility of the judiciary, not hurts it.
So is it your position that on the highest court, due process doesn't apply as to disqualification of a fellow justice?
No, I think it does, Your Honor.
So you think that the U.S. Supreme Court may be faced with a case of due process and have to make a decision about its own brethren?
And I think,
or sister,
unlikely as it might be, that any five of those men and women could decide that one of their colleagues, for stated reasons, not unstated reasons, should not sit on a case. I mean,
have you studied that question, or are you just kind of shooting from the hip for us today?
Thank you.
Yeah. It might be a little more complicated than you're aware of.
Let's get back to this case.
But Justice Rogenczak, it's the only time I'm doing it.
Mr. Williamson, what is your response? We've heard two sides here, and the one advanced by those who filed the petition originally and others have said the due process rights of those appearing before the court have to be balanced against the political free speech of the citizens who are going to support particular candidates, but we just think that the due process is so, at the end of the balancing process, it's the due process that outweighs the free speech. What is your response to that?
Your Honor, it's often been said that with respect to the First Amendment, the framers did the balancing. I don't view this as balancing, because I don't think that any court can burden or penalize the exercise of political speech by making recusal.
But the counter,
the threat of recusal, the price.
The counter to that that we've been hearing is that, well, they certainly have the right to express themselves politically through speech and otherwise, but they don't have the right to the judge of their choosing. So they may support the judge, they may financially contribute to the candidate, the successful candidate, but when it comes time for their case, if they should be a lawyer or a party to such a case to be in front of that particular judge or justice, well, there is no right to have that judge or justice take part in their particular case. I think that's the narrower question.
But, Your Honor, first of all, that argument disintegrates in the matrix of this court. Because if there is a recusal and only six justices sit, and those six are divided evenly, there is no decision by the highest court in this state, which is a point I think that both Justice Rogenczak and Justice Ziegler have made. Now, with respect to the trial court, let's go back to Langlade County. Why would we want an electoral system in which the people of a county elect a judge, and then that judge, by virtue of having been elected with support of the people, is subject to recusal because in a $5,000 race, somebody contributed $750? I mean, that's just inconsistent with our notion of an elected judiciary.
Counsel, I'm sorry.
Just very briefly, because of all the mention of Langlade County, as a former assistant DA of Langlade County, I will mention to my former boss and good friend, Judge Kowalski, he was well remembered here today, and will have plenty of guidance should someone give him $25 in the next race. Thank you.
Justice Bradley,
thank you. What should be my goal here today in deciding this case? Let me extend that. What should be the goal of the Wisconsin Supreme Court? What should be our goal in hearing these motions?
To ensure that political speech does not impermissibly burden the bench, the bar, litigants, or to use Justice Rogensack's example, all of the other people who decide to support candidate A or candidate B for office?
Indeed. I think you hit on everything that had been said in terms of the First Amendment concerns, guarding the First Amendment, the guarding the due process rights of litigants, guarding the rights of the citizens to have the justices they elected sit on the case, guarding the rights of citizens to a fair court. Maybe I see also enhancing the public trust and confidence in the judiciary. I see those as our goals. So tell me why granting the petition enhances the goal of protecting the right of citizens to a fair court.
Because you will be saying to the people of this state that the act of supporting a candidate for judge is not only to be not discouraged, but encouraged. You will be saying to the people of this state that we've had judicial elections since 1848, we're going to have judicial elections in 2048, and raising money or spending your own to become a judge is, assuming it's legal disclosed, is honorable and is not to be the subject of a recusal motion because of the perception that there's a connection between a legal contribution and a result in this court.
Fair enough. The other goal, or one of the other goals, is to enhance the public trust and confidence in the judiciary. Tell me how passing the petition that a judge shall not be required to recuse himself or herself in a proceeding where the recusal is based solely on an independent expenditure, how that enhances that goal of preserving the public trust and confidence in the judiciary.
I would give a similar answer, Justice Bradley, with the little appendix. And the appendix would simply be that this court and the judiciary in general cares about itself and examines its own practices and procedures regularly to ensure that they are, at the risk of being saccharine, worthy of the trust that an elected position places in you.
If we say, after deliberation, and not only deliberation, but ponderous deliberation, let's make it really judicial, then that process in and of itself should give the public confidence and trust. That the process you seem to be suggesting is the destination. That makes me sound like a child of the 60s. The journey is the destination. You're saying the process is the answer. I don't know. I don't know if the process, I mean, it's part of it, but don't you think the answer is also the answer?
Sure. And the fact that you're going to do it in public is fairly significant as well, because this is a rule hearing, not a case.
Mm-hmm.
And I think what you're saying to people, the public, is we know this is an issue. We know credibility is an issue. And we're going to address it. And the Supreme Court in Caperton said something that's worth addressing, but we've been trying to address it before Caperton. But there's been a lot said today about perception. And yes, the perception of the judiciary is very important. And, of course, it can't be any worse than the perception of the bar. But the perception of the judiciary is something to be protected and guarded. But I'm reminded that a number of years ago, a legendary reporter for the Capital Times in Madison, on the 4th of July, stood on the square had a petition, asked people to sign it. It was the Bill of Rights. And he couldn't get very many signatures. And that's a reminder that the job of this court is not to do what's popular. Sometimes you get to, sometimes you don't. But that isn't your role. So as important as perception is, your oath is what's really important. And again, I think, Justice Bradley, to confront the tiger advances public confidence. It certainly doesn't retard it. And I will end on this point. Another study, this is a problem that can be solved, if not today, next month, January, February, but this court, unless it addresses this soon, is going to see more Donahue cases, and they're going to start at the trial court. They're not going to start at this court. They're going to end up at this court. Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you, Mr. Williamson. I'll ask one more time, is there anyone else who wishes to appear on any of these petitions? If not, the hearings on 0816, 0825, it's 25, not 26, 0910, and 0911, the hearing is closed. The court will take a 10-minute recess and be back and sit in open administrative conference. We are adjourned on this hearing. We will come back and open administrative conference, and we have a hearing on another set of petitions tomorrow.